From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some of the biggest names in high tech weighed in at an annual A-list conference in California this week. From Bill Gates to Steve Jobs to Intel's new CEO, Paul Otellini, and many more. At the top of the agenda, the ever-evolving face of the new digital technologies taking over the 21st century. Morphing PCs, wide-area Wi-Fi, booming blogs, deep search, and more. Tonight on Point, all things digital from the top of the high-tech heap. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where President Bush met today with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and pledged $50 million in direct aid to the Palestinian Authority. It was an opportunity for Bush to speak to Mideast peace and to boost Abbas before Palestinians vote in parliamentary elections in July. Julie Mason is White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle and joins me now. Julie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom.
What's the conversation post the meetings? How are the two sides coming out, Washington and Abbas? Are they satisfied with today's meeting and announcements?
They are, and it was very interesting, Tom. Bush spent way more time with Abbas than he usually does with visiting dignitaries, and it was all very symbolic. It was all meant to sort of bolster Abbas and lift him up. It was very interesting.
What were the agendas going into the meeting today, first for President Bush?
Well, Bush is very concerned about these parliamentary elections that you mentioned. Hamas is mounting a strong challenge to Abbas's Fatah party, and Bush wants to make sure that Abbas is in a very strong position and stays right where he is. And Abbas really needs Bush's help. That direct aid is not a princely sum, but it's very significant in that it is, as you noted, the first time the U.S. is giving direct aid to the Palestinians rather than going through some sort of non-governmental third party. So symbolically, it's very important, even though $50 million won't go very far with all the needs they have there.
Which means Mahmoud Abbas has a lot more say over how and where it will be spent in the coming months.
Presumably. Yes, indeed he will, which also helps him politically.
President Bush saw Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon recently.
At the ranch in Crawford.
That's right. That's a very different setting, but can you compare the tone of the two meetings and the two joint appearances?
Yes, it was interesting. Bush was careful in both meetings to not directly criticize either side. The sides criticize each other, but Bush tries to stay above the fray. And he did that with Sharon last time. He said that Sharon must comply with the roadmap. He said that Israel should not be expanding its settlements, which is a key bone of contention between the parties. But he stopped short of saying what the U.S. would do if Sharon proceeds. And much in this way, today with Abbas, Bush was asked directly, did he believe that Abbas has done enough to eradicate terrorism among Palestinians, mm-hmm. and that's obviously a very key sticking point with the Israelis. And Bush did not answer the question. He did not even address it. He began to talk about democracy.
He ducked
it. So that was very interesting.
And what about Mahmoud Abbas? What was his public message to President Bush, to the American people?
Gratitude upon gratitude. The man was smiling so hard. He was so happy. This was a huge boost to him. And he said that he is very committed to the roadmap. He wants to move ahead. He wants to work with the Israelis. And he feels like he said time is becoming our enemy. He feels a sense of urgency about the process.
Was it clear what he meant by that? This conflict has gone on for so long. President Bush pledging today not to see another generation go into lifetimes of violence. But what's the edge of urgency that Abbas is referring to? How would you describe it?
Well, a big part of that is the upcoming elections. Abbas could really be threatened by this. And if Hamas does grow their power at his expense, it would be a huge setback to the process. So he really needs help and made that very clear.
Julie, the White House, President Bush saying today that on the other side of the planned Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, the United States will really reengage with the roadmap peace process. What does that mean in practical terms? The United States has seemed to have more talk than real shoulder to the wheel there. What's planned now?
It's true. Well, it's interesting. The White House really is pushing the focus to be on Gaza because they don't really want to talk about these West Bank settlement expansions. So Bush is sending the Secretary of State down to Israel, and she's going to Ramallah, and she's going to work with the parties, and Rice and her people are really going to be the ones who Bush hopes will get it done and do the diplomacy and the heavy lifting, and it sort of relieves Bush from having to do anything more than just talking these sort of broad political strokes about democracy.
On the scene, it will be very interesting to see how that plays out. Julie, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Sure, thank you, Tom.
Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with me from Washington. You have your cell phone, maybe your BlackBerry, your Wi-Fi, and you're wondering, what's next? This week, some of the biggest players in high tech, from Bill Gates to Steve Jobs, presented their visions of the future in the digital realm. Tonight, we're talking about what they see and inviting you to share your own view on where digital technology stands today and where it goes, where it needs to go next. You're welcome in this conversation. What tech innovations are you waiting for on the digital frontier or just at home with your PC, with your cell phone? What's the next big thing? Or the next little thing that you really need right now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Kara Swisher, co-host of the Wall Street Journal's annual technology conference, D, All Things Digital, and technology writer in the journal's San Francisco Bureau. She writes on high-tech issues in her column, Boomtown. Kara Swisher, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Describe this get-together in California this week. You guys put it on. Who shows up? What goes on?
Well, we had everybody from Bill Gates, who everybody knows is the co-founder of Microsoft, Steve Jobs, who's running Apple Computer, which right now is very hot with the iPod. The two founders of Yahoo, Jerry Yang and David Filo, and someone like Barry Diller, who owns several interactive companies, is also very famous for being a Hollywood figure.
And on and on. It's a great big list of movers and shakers here. We're going to dive into some of the details of what they laid out,
sure.
But give us the tone first, Kara. You followed this whole digital boom revolution, call
from
it what you will, from the beginning. You saw it in the 90s when it was fizz and bubble and furious and then flat. Where does this sort of big mo stand today?
There's a big misconception. It was never flat. The stock market was flat. And when it became a stock story, everybody lost interest in it. But the fact of the matter is, since then, the digitization has continued on forward in everything. And it hasn't stopped just because the stock market had a problem.
Absolutely. But, you know, I was in Silicon Valley in the 90s, and I was there after the stock market plummeted. And there was a very different atmosphere, I'd have to say, in the air.
No, it's an atmosphere because everyone didn't get rich. But that's, you know, you're losing focus on the fact that everything is going digital. All the entertainment, mm-hmm. it sort of decimated the music industry. It's moving on to Hollywood. To movies and TV and all sorts of areas. The newspaper industry is under siege from blogs and different things like that. So I think people tend to confuse the money with the innovations. And in a very short time, a large amount of people, the entire country and the entire world, got to be on the Internet. It's amazing. That didn't happen that fast with highways or railroads or things like that.
It is absolutely amazing. And as you say,
it was cheap, really. If you think about it, it really was cheap. It was just some investment. You know what I mean?
Yep, and it goes on apace, but it's something about that nexus of the money momentum and the technology momentum that makes up an atmosphere. And I wonder if people are really feeling their oats again now. Are they feeling, you know, we're back in the saddle. We've got the whip hand again here.
Right, I do think they do, definitely. I think there's definitely a supremacy of, you know, look at the stock of Google right now. It's in the stratosphere. Very similar to the old days. Not everybody is going that way, though. There's not a million companies like that. It's just a few select ones who survived and thrived after the shakeout. Yahoo's doing very well, obviously. Many Barry Diller's companies are doing very well. Microsoft is attempting to sort of make the transition. So the ones that are left are quite strong and are going to be very important players going forward in not just the tech industry, but throughout the entertainment industry, the communications industry, phones and wireless and all sorts of things. So these really are important, critical companies going forward.
Kara, begin to take us into the big themes and challenges that seem to define the week. What was top of mind?
Well, I think one of the big areas is the digitization of everything. This is the idea that everything has an IP, an Internet Protocol address, that newspapers and all sorts of communications, that music goes digital, that TV goes digital. I mean, the idea that TV could go over the Internet and not over networks and broadcast is really interesting because then you get to choose your shows. Obviously, wireless is a big, big area, and mobility of information, mobility of the ability to get things. Mel Karmazin, who used to run CBS and Viacom, now is head of something called Sirius Satellite Radio, and he was talking about the ability of Sirius to broadcast traffic signals into the cars, into the navigation system, so you'd know where a blockage is. And it's something that's very doable very soon. And so it's this idea of mobility of information everywhere, from the very big cars, which will be full of digital devices, to the very small PDAs you carry in your hand.
And what about the big frustrations, the things that just aren't happening at the pace that people hoped or dreamed or really want?
I think navigation was one issue. It's really hard to navigate. We showed several companies.
You mean navigating computer sites, computers, websites?
You know, mm-hmm. The search as it is right now, say on Google or Yahoo, you know, you just put in an, it's very crude, it's almost Neanderthal the way you search. You put in a name or a word, and it comes out with millions of responses, and it's not very contextual. And Barry Diller, who just bought Astes for over $1 billion, was talking about that, which is another search service, not as famous as the other two. But he was talking about contextual searching, which is, if you're searching, say, Kara Swisher, you might want to know my relationship with Walt Mossberg, who I do the conference with, but you might want to know my book, or something like that. So the idea that this stuff is very crude at this point, and it's going to become more visual, more with video, more in a way that really does become about you rather than just a broad search.
And $1 billion for Ask Jeeves, which is kind of at the bottom of the search pyramid. Search must really be hot.
6 or 7%, I think. I mean, it's doing very well. It's making a lot of money. I mean, all these search engines are making a lot of money. And that's another area. It's because advertising is really shifting a lot. There's an industry that's just being completely transformed by internet and digital applications, because you can now reach advertisers in a way that you advertisers could reach consumers in a way, and advertisers are asking of their old traditional client people they bought advertising for, newspapers, TV networks, well, you're not very effective, but here I am effective.
Are you really still working for me? Kara Swisher with the Wall Street Journal. Stand by. We're talking tonight about the hot word on the latest in digital technology. You can join the conversation. What are you waiting for in the digital realm? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting the hot word tonight on the latest in digital technology and a glimpse of the new digital future as described by some of the biggest names in the tech world. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Half a decade after the Internet 90s, what's come quicker than you dreamed? What is maddeningly absent? What's working in your digital present? And what do you want in your digital future? And maybe this, with this lineup we're talking about tonight, are America's high-tech titans giving the digital revolution the leadership it needs, it deserves? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Kara Swisher, famous for her Boomtown column right from the early, from the 90s on. She's co-host of the Wall Street Journal's D, All Things Digital, big conference that just took place this week in California. She's technology writer in the Wall Street Journal's San Francisco Bureau. We're also joined tonight from San Francisco by John Markoff, senior writer for the New York Times. He's been writing about technology since the late 70s. John Markoff, you were at the conference as well this week. Thanks for being with us tonight. What turned your head?
What turned my head? Well, I guess how quickly Microsoft followed Google, announcing some of the same features that Google had announced the week before.
You're talking satellite mapping.
And personalization.
And Bill Gates once again saying, there's a frontier I've got to be on. Can he find a settlement location there?
A settlement location.
Well, can he is there room for Microsoft? Has Google done it all?
Kara pointed out that the advertising world is changing, and what's happening as a result of that, there's so many advertising dollars flowing into these guys. I think there's a lot of room for both of them to grow for quite a while.
And when I asked Kara about the mood and tone, I mean, some of us will be on the outside looking in, others working right in the high-tech industry, but how would you characterize the kind of mood and tone at this high-level gathering, John?
Well, I think people feel like the industry is back after a rough 4 years. You could definitely feel it there, but it's spotty. You know, the parts, as she said, parts of the valley are back, but the jobs haven't come back. Investments come back, but the jobs, in some cases, are in India and in China.
And does that matter, Kara Swisher? Do people at a conference like this care where the jobs are, or is it let's have the ideas and follow wherever we need to make them happen?
No, I think it is an industry that does accept the mobility of things. I mean, I think all the griping and the jobs have gotten smaller because there's not as many silly companies existing. But I think this is an industry that does realize that things move, and it's a global industry, and they can't, they're not going to sit around and gripe about it, presumably. They're going to move their jobs to China and to India and wherever there's growth. I don't, you know, I think obviously people losing jobs in Silicon Valley, it stinks, but you know, it's inevitable as this thing becomes a global industry, and that's what it is. Not everywhere on the globe. We had Nicholas Negroponte talking about the $100 computer project he's trying to create, which would distribute these very, I don't want to call them crude laptops because they're not, but these very low-cost laptops.
Globally.
Globally to people and use to people that need them in small villages, in places they don't have the ability to afford these things. And then use, you know, wireless technologies because they're just going to skip over the whole cable high-speed thing mm-hmm. and go right to wireless. It's an interesting idea, I mean, if people being connected everywhere on the planet.
And John, what about the next frontier? There's a lot we want to talk about what's going on right now, but digital conferences are always very future-oriented. What looks like the next big thing, the next big challenge?
Well, you know, these things come in ebbs and goes. There are years that are hotter than others. And, you know, I think that my sense was that maybe there was more sort of buzz about products last year than there was this year, things that at least I was interested in. I think the one thing that I think has stuck out and showed up this year is the just explosion of everything peer-to-peer. You know, we're
cutting out the kind of middleman technology.
Well, no, I think it's more that there's this real explosion of user-created content. Even while mm-hmm. the Supreme Court is struggling over file sharing, people are sharing all kinds of stuff that they've created themselves. It's quite legal, mm-hmm. and it's become just an enormous part of the Internet.
I think Steve Jobs discussed that with his the podcasting on iTunes. iTunes is it goes with iPod, which is the most
yep.
popular music player. But now he's going to have listings of podcasting. And for those who don't know what it is, it's people making recordings and posting them on the Internet, and then you download them into your iPod and listen to them. And he's going to have a service that you can search for them and you can load them up and people can get them. And that's all user-generated, isn't, you know, Tom Brokaw or whoever. creating this. I mean, he could if he wanted, but it could be anybody.
And Kara, what about for the titans you've got there? Does peer-to-peer make them feel cut out of the loop, or
no.
is that just as rich a vein for them to mine as any other?
Green fields for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about if you're a network. That's different. This is new stuff. They're starting from, this will be new businesses for them. I think Barry Diller was very interesting in talking about the gatedness of it, although he still, and I think quite correctly, said that you still need really good stories, and he was thinking it would be good to be an independent producer of content right now because distribution costs are much lower and much easier to get the word out. But it still goes back to having great content. You have to have a great story, or else you're, you know. And he wanted to be in competition with the big companies because he thinks they're sort of constrained by costs, having to create these big tentpole movies that really just stink that nobody wants to see. And if you're creative, you could have a real in now because of distribution on the Internet.
John, you had Anna Marie Cox there, Wonkette at Wonkette.com, kind of the saucy seer over there, saying, hey, it's a great big party. But I'm also reading here, she's saying, you know, the first round of blogs have themselves become kind of institutional now. So where's the edge of peer-to-peer?
Oh, well, where's the edge? I think one of the most interesting peer-to-peer things I've seen recently, he wasn't at Karen Wall's event, but Will Wright has got a new game. This is a guy who invented Sims, and mm-hmm. his new game, which will be out next year, is called Spore. And Spore is entirely based on sort of exploiting user-created civilizations, actually, is what they are, for people to explore. And he's going to populate an entire universe that you'll be able to explore all with things that the users of the game have created, which is a really sort of different take on
that's amazing.
Online games.
So it's about exploring, but the name will be Spore, as in a drifting seed, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of a sci-fi idea.
Wow, it's a cool idea. I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I can. Bruce is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Thanks. How are you guys doing this evening?
We're great. What's on your mind, Bruce?
Well, I work for a local TV station, one of the, quote, old media.
Yep.
And one point that somebody had explained to me once that I think really is pertinent to this conversation is with all the explosion of new media and all the changes that are going on, is that there, in the history of mass communication or in the history of communication, there's never been one form of mass communication that's replaced another.
No.
The role has changed. There have been things that have the level of importance, the way that content is delivered. But
you mean it's kind of a toss? It's been a toss salad kind of evolution.
Well,
stuff altogether.
Really, if you really think about it, if one form of mass communication would always replace another, we wouldn't have any newspapers today.
So does that leave you feeling threatened or not threatened, Bruce?
No, I think that there's really a lot of people perhaps misunderstand or overstate that, you know, as in this case, digital media comes into play. A lot of the internet applications, the internet resources are being discussed. You almost get the feeling, if you really don't look back at the history of this, that that this is all there's going to be. This will be the only choice. There may be a new dominant choice, or there may be a new flavor of the month, if you will. But
and your job may depend on it. Kara Swisher, I hear you there in California.
I think it's just TV, movies and television replace theater and radio. Well, they're not as relevant. I mean, I think that's the question. It's a question of relevance. Sure, they'll still survive. Obviously, newspapers will be around. They just won't be as relevant. And that's the whole point to, you know, having power, I suppose, is being relevant. And I think that if the most important thing here, and that has never occurred, is that users have control of what they want. They don't have to take, I don't mean to use the word crap, but they don't have to take whatever people in the top of the media send them down to them. They can pick and choose what they want. And that is a very powerful difference. You could never decide what network TV show you could get. You just have to take the good show, and then you have to put up with three bad shows. If you had a record, you had to take the two good songs with the 10 bad songs that you didn't want. And now it's pick and choose, and that's a very powerful difference because people create their own relevance. And I think, you know, if you're in local news, they could, there's all sorts of different things they can get information from. You know, there's one great company, Don Graham of the Washington Post, who was on one of the newspaper panels, talked about it, called Backfence. Is that right, John? Backfence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all local. It's written by local people. And it's and Dan Gilmer, who is on another another thing, is doing something called Bayosphere about the San Francisco Bay Area. It starts to get really interesting when there's just more than the gatekeepers in charge.
You had a bunch of newspaper people there. And Bruce, thanks for your call. And you know, we wish you well with that TV job in Raleigh. But there's clearly a lot of ferment here. John Markoff, you did have Don Graham there from the Washington Post, Peter Kahn with Dow Jones, Tony Ritter of Knight Ritter. What was your sense of how the newspaper people were looking at this oncoming, ever-rising?
You should let Kara describe that. I was not there for that panel. So, Kara, what was your...
They were actually very eloquent, I thought, about their prospects. I think they're definitely concerned, I think. They understand what's happening. They're not sticking their head in the sand. But at the same time, the onslaught is on how people read. And I think what was nice to hear, actually, was that all three of them understood this and were thinking of their newspapers not as a piece of paper, but as the content. It doesn't really matter how things are distributed. I mean, it does matter for the business plan how much money you can make in each. But I think they understand what their real value is the trusted news source of information. And that never changes, no matter what the medium is. It doesn't matter what you get it on. So I was very heartened, actually. I thought they would be more defeated looking. But I, you know, it's going to cost them, and they're going to have to figure out a great new business plan. And it's a question of whether the DNA exists in newspapers, not just in their companies, throughout the country, to make this you know, transition when they've got something like Google, who I think their one quarter is as much as some of their yearly annual things in just a short time.
So a brave face, but clearly big challenges there. Kara, John, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from New York Stephen Levy, senior editor and chief technology writer for Newsweek. His weekly column is The Technologist. He was also at the big conference this week. Stephen Levy, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So you heard a lot of people, no doubt high-placed people, giving their pitch, giving their view. Who seemed to be really strong? Who seemed to be high in the saddle this year?
Well, as always, you know, one great thing about the conference is that Walt Malzberg and Kara managed to rope in both Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who are the two titans of the industry, and it's always interesting to hear what they have to say. Bill these days, I think, is a little more defensive because you know, there's this contention that his company is sort of hit a middle age and isn't as much on the cutting edge. They have these terrific cash cows of Windows and, you know, their Office application suite, and they're looking for other ways to make money and make themselves important. And it looks like they might have a good thing going with this new version of their game console called Xbox. Mm-hmm. They just announced recently it's called the Xbox 360, and they're beating Sony to the gate with this new generation of that. And, you know, Steve Jobs, as always, was charismatic. One nice, interesting surprise was, who impressed a lot of people, was Ed Zander of Motorola.
Yeah.
He spoke and...
huge in cell phones, of course.
Right, he hadn't been there before. And he impressed a lot of people. One little sub-theme running through a lot of the talks, Steve Jobs first brought it up, was the idea of the creativity of the Silicon Valley folks and the openness of computers was being thwarted in some degrees by what he called orifices, which are gates that are being blocked by these trolls, I guess.
You're starting to lose me here. Orifices and trolls. What's the blockage?
Orifices meaning, I guess passageways, I guess is a nice way to put it. Not a very elegant term. But specifically, he was talking in the telecommunications realm and phones of, these carriers you have. There's only a few carriers in America who will handle your wireless cell phone needs.
Right.
And in order to get on your handset, the thing you buy when you get your phone service, you have to go through them. Even though the handset is increasingly a computer, you can't load your own program on it like you can with your regular computer.
You've got to deal with these big gatekeepers, and they may not be open to what's out there to have.
No, unless it makes money for them, they're not interested in letting you have it. And if it makes money for them, they might charge you more than if you did it yourself. For instance, ringtones, the sounds that happens when you get a phone call, are a huge business, and they charge a few dollars just for about 30 seconds worth of music.
I want to get another caller here. Nick is calling from Topsfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is the great thing you're talking about, the ability to the Xbox and all that. My issue is with supposedly convergent technology. So, my experience right now is really the family experience is very divergent. I got a carload of kids with multiple music players and people listening to different stuff and different devices competing for shelf space in my home entertainment system, or people trying to tell me how to integrate the different computer systems.
So you don't see your TV and your PC and your iPod and your BlackBerry and your cell phone all converging? They're still running around separate?
Well, I've been waiting for it. I've been looking for it all the time. And then right now it's definitely still more divergent than convergent. When are people going to really start to integrate this stuff, and how is that going to take shape?
Nick, it's a great question. Let us pick it up. John Markoff, can you speak to that?
Well, the problem is that all of these guys have their own version of their own vision and version of convergence. And so even after, if you stick within the Microsoft womb, at some point, Microsoft will get to the TV with their TV products. And in theory, their TV products in the living room should talk to the TV, to the PC products in the bedroom. But whether they're going to talk to Apple's products or Sony's products or Toshiba's products, that's anybody's bet. As a matter of fact, I think he's onto something with divergence. I think it's always been divergence, and the promise of convergence is going to remain a promise for a long time.
Kara Swisher, how big a deal, how big a problem is that? I mean, can you have convergence and the kind of creative chaos that this industry has thrived on?
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of convergence. I just think it's a nice word, but I think it never happens. I don't think with all these competing companies you're ever going to get anything that really works well.
But isn't that a structural problem? Because people like our caller are saying, I want these things to work together. My life is too hectic.
He buys all the devices. I think they kind of like the idea that he buys all the devices.
Right. They don't want to converge.
I mean, there has to be almost a dictator above everyone, which some people thought Microsoft was, and I don't think it's as much as it was. It still is very powerful.
Well, a dictator or else very, very, very open systems somehow.
Sure, open systems, absolutely, if you get to that point. But it's still people are going to make different devices. And, ultimately you do have to coalesce around standards. But there's so much going on here. I just think that word convergence is just bandied about. And, since I was, before I was born, and it's going to be after I'm dead, I think. I just don't think I think the idea of a one device is just not going to happen from my perspective.
Stephen Levy, what about it? Does the digital revolution work without convergence?
Well, I actually think you're honestly with these open standards. They're there, and when someone comes up with a product that doesn't adhere to them, it's really up to the marketplace to put pressure on for that company to follow the standards. Right now, a great example of that is the iPod and iTunes. This is the software which gets the songs on the iPod. It has a huge market share, but it doesn't work with anything else. If you get any other kind of player, it won't work with Apple's software where you could buy the tunes online, and if you buy your tunes somewhere else, you can't put them on an iPod.
So is that just the way it's going to be in this century?
No, it's not. Steve Jobs right now says, well, I don't have to change because my customers don't want me to, but if there are songs that his customers want that they can't get on the iPod, sooner or later, they'll make him break down and follow the standards. And I think eventually that'll happen, but by then, of course, we'll have another product which doesn't adhere to other standards.
Wow, this is a terrific conversation. We want to hear much more. We've got a lot of callers waiting to join us. Stephen Levy with Newsweek, John Markoff, New York Times, Kara Swisher with The Wall Street Journal are all with us tonight. You can join us as well. If you had the microphone, what's your big burning question for Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Scott McNeely, Jerry Yang? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're getting the fresh word tonight on the latest in digital technology as described by some of the biggest names in the tech world at this week's D, All Things Digital Conference, sponsored by the Wall Street Journal in California. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What's the buzz in your neck of the digital universe? Were you lucky enough to be at the conference? What big idea did you bring home? And what do you want next from your cell phone, your PDA, your TV, your Wi-Fi connection, from the whole big digital universe? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Kara Swisher, co-host, co-creator of the big conference in California and a writer for the Wall Street Journal, John Markoff, technology writer for the New York Times, and Stephen Levy, tech writer for Newsweek magazine. Right now, John's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Hi. One of the more intriguing things to me this year was the fact that Philadelphia was going to be setting up a citywide system. And then the other one that
this is Wi-Fi, so that anybody can get on wireless to the internet in Philly.
Right, it would be ubiquitous, or this WiMAX that goes 30 miles, and it opens up a whole new universe. And one of the things that I thought of that always bothered me, I wasn't a big fan of Tipper Gore when she was on her censorship binge,
right, anti-raunchy campaign.
Right, and what I was thinking was, if you have a ubiquitous internet, it would be very easy to have private censorship where you could build intelligent devices, not just TVs. You could have DVD player or MP3 player or a CD player that actually you would hook into a private sensor.
Why would that be more easy in a ubiquitous access arena?
Well, in the sense that you have the internet there, so once it identifies what the music is or the video is or what is playing, it can actually contact whoever your private censor is. So it could be Jewish Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, or it could be the American Civil Liberties Union, or whoever you would choose as your private censor. And it would interact back and forth where the device could actually communicate and actually say, this is what I'm listening to. And then you would pick out a censor that reflects your own sensibilities. So if sex and violence isn't what's necessarily wrong, but it's the context that the sex and violence is used in, you could pick out a sensor that would reflect that sensibility, and it would be aware that this movie may have violent content or sexual content, but it's used in a good way that's educational.
So your kind
children.
Of personal go-to nanny there, or maybe your go-to pimp, depending what you want. John, thanks for the call. Kara, John, Stephen, what do you think?
I guess my mother's voice in the back of my head is my own private sensor, but there are a lot of parental controls available from your internet providers to do a lot of what the caller said. I think one of the interesting things about the Philadelphia program, which you talked about, was the vigor with which some of the people who want to sell you that internet service have been fighting it, and they wound up with a compromise that Philadelphia could help supply internet to its citizens for a small fee, but the rest of the state couldn't do that in other municipalities. For instance, in Pittsburgh, you couldn't get that. And I find that sort of ironic because I think that free or low-cost internet is a great economic development tool, much better than, say, sports stadiums. And in Pennsylvania, they spent a fortune for both baseball and football stadiums both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
Right. So instead, open it up. Kara, what about this WiMAX kind of very wide range access technology? Where's that stand?
I think it's inevitable everywhere. It's going to be like the highway. I know these cable companies and telcos are fighting it, and they're very powerful and they can lobby these politicians. But it's such a popular idea.
You're saying ubiquitous wireless access is inevitable.
I think of other countries. It's so pathetic. Last year at the conference, we had Masayoshi Son, who was an investor, who was an early investor in Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the United States being the third world of high speed access, and he's entirely right. Other countries, Korea. Has better, has amazing access. Some small countries, I think Nicholas Negroponte talked about how Cambodia, or Venice. No, I think it was Barry Diller was just in Venice, and their access is better. It's pathetic.
We know what it's like to sit in Starbucks or a university library, but yeah. what's possible today, Carol?
Presumably, John can talk a little bit about some experiments he did early in San Francisco with some other entrepreneurs that he knows about providing access all through the city. This was under the cuff kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
but the idea of it is huge, and I think it's going to happen. I think there's going to be this, if someone's going to provide it, and these cable companies and telcos are not going to be able to stop it eventually.
John Markoff, what have you seen? What did you see?
Well, San Francisco had a very early experiment where people were putting up towers on their houses and offering free Wi-Fi to their neighbors, and I think that it's not clear yet which technology. Caller mentioned WiMAX. WiMAX has not been proven in urban areas yet, but it's clearly a player. The cell guy.
What is WiMAX, John?
WiMAX is a variant of Wi-Fi that mm-hmm. has much greater range. They play with the technology a bit to give you the ability to serve an entire urban area with just a few towers.
Miles, maybe what, 50 miles?
I think 50 miles is. I think that's theoretically possible.
Okay.
But in theory, you might need just a half a dozen towers to serve an urban area, as opposed to your Wi-Fi. Range is just a couple hundred feet, so you your neighbor can pick you up. And
yeah.
some people are trying that approach. They're trying putting standard Wi-Fi technology into meshes, and your message is passed from one to the other. People are playing with that. The other thing that's out there that is starting to happen is sending internet data over power lines. And there are people who believe that they'll be able to get very high data rates to your house through your power network.
Mm.
And so I think that one way or another, this stuff is going to be ubiquitous, whether it's over the air or through a variety of networks.
Well, if it'll help clean up the rat's nest of wires running all over my house and everybody else's, I'd be glad for it. Betsy's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Betsy. You're on the air.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And you're sort of singing my song there about users. I would love for users to be able to have a little bit more control. I mean, all of this looking to the future is very nice, but can we look backwards? And I cannot manage my email. I don't know anyone who can manage their email. Is anyone looking into this?
Just the simple kind of navigation of what you've got going digitally already, Betsy.
Oh, no.
You wish it were simple. You wish. Kara, you mentioned navigation earlier. That seems part of it.
Navigation and management of this stuff is really important. The ability to find things, find and use and be relevant to you. I think there's a lot of noise out there. And I think the great companies are going to be the ones that really put it into your hands in a way that's easy to use. I mean, I think it's a crime that, for the most part, you can't put your phone numbers from your PC into your PDA very easily, unless you have a certain kind of thing. I mean, some of them work, some of them don't work. All sorts of different ways you move about information is really still very hard to do, and I consider myself pretty good at it, and I still, throw things against the wall.
So is that really getting solved, or is this dirty secret of the industry that users are just going to have to live with that forever?
Not forever, I think, but for now, I mean, I think it's just not... It's not at an excellent pace. I still consider, again, I said search is Neanderthal at this point. I mean, typing a word in and getting a million responses, come on. That's just, it's not relevant. It's just, and now they're so heavily weighted towards shopping. The first 30, things you get back are shopping.
Buy me, buy me, buy me. Shamil's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Shamil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to echo Betsy's comment, too, that we're thinking about all these high-tech technologies coming out, but a lot of people still don't, have trouble managing, simple
the
things
basics,
like mail.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring up a point that was making a lot of waves a while back about internet-based appliances, which is basically you remove the computer out of the way and you create these appliances that are based on the internet. They're connected to the internet, but they're very easy to use, just like your TV. So you just do mail by turning some gadget on,
mm-hmm.
and you manage the mail. So the computer is completely out of the picture and is a very easy-to-use appliance.
And are you saying you're still waiting for all that to be real in your life, Shamil?
Yes, I heard about it a few years ago.
Right. So where's the beef? Let us pick it up. Stephen Levy, how about it? All these appliances that were supposed to be plugged in, Bluetoothed in, you name it.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and it's right. A few years ago, we were hearing things about, say, boom boxes that would plug into the internet, and they'd be able to play internet radio, any audio that came over the internet, and you wouldn't have a computer attached. I think probably what held it back was those first things were pretty expensive, and weren't as easy to use, didn't have the functionality of just a regular table radio, so they didn't catch on. But I think maybe with more wireless in people's homes without having to fiddle with some cable or something like that, maybe we'll see the resurgence of those.
Lots of maybes. John Markoff, I wanted to ask you before we run out of time here about security. There's been so much talk about identity theft and people hacking into other people's stuff. Bill Gates, I see, got raked over the coals a little bit again, given Microsoft's sort of Windows central place and all that. What is the latest word? What were you hearing about security at this gathering?
Gates was trying to make the point that, actually, I thought it was a pretty disappointing point, that he was sort of arguing at the conference that Microsoft has gotten better and that the problem is actually this thing they call social engineering now. Things like phishing where anonymous people fool you over the internet. So he was a little bit shifting the blame, saying we've hardened our software and now it's these spoofs that are a big problem, which
the people are the problem.
The people are the problem, right? It was a bit disingenuous. The problems are still out there and they're as bad as ever in the internet. I think we haven't seen a super bad virus yet, but we're seeing a host of sort of social cons and things like that, and people are finding more and more sophisticated ways to exploit people. I don't think it's gotten much better at all. I mean, there was just a recent story that I reported about a 16-year-old from Sweden who spent a year sort of walking into all kinds of computers, both in government in the United States and corporate computers, and sort of browsing through stuff. The computers were reasonably open to him, even though they were supposed to be secured at national labs.
Yeah, and in walks a boy. Kara Swisher, we just got half a minute left here. I don't know, your big takeaway. Lots of folks, lots of big ideas, lots of simple requests here from our callers. How's it all come together?
Well, just for your last caller, Scott McNeely talked about that computer again, creating that computer that's just that you can move your card anywhere and then your information is on whatever screen you go to, which is an interesting idea. We'll see if Sun, which is a troubled company, can do something like that.
Now, give me that again. You can move your what anywhere?
You have a card and your internet, you exist on a server somewhere and you don't exist on a laptop. Getting rid of the hard drive, getting rid of the complexity.
So you're kind of a virtual entity,
right.
Less easily hacked.
Back to the future, back to the client of the server now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the thing you're talking about, this is just going to continue. I mean, this is digitization is part of our lives, wherever you are on the spectrum. If you're a Luddite or if you really are a super geek, and that's what's important to think about, and where it's going to go and what it means societally is really important.
Well, it is fun to try and keep up with the speeding train and watch the lagging caboose. Stephen Levy at Newsweek, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And John Markoff with the New York Times, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Kara Swisher, thank you for all the work you put into pulling this thing together and for letting us put our ear to the ground with you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Kara Swisher with The Wall Street Journal. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the autobiography of a Marine sniper. This is On Point. Jack Coughlin skillfully killed people for a living. Before his recent retirement, Coughlin was the U.S. Marine Corps' top sniper. His record was 60 confirmed kills, more than anyone else in the military today. Coughlin served in Iraq in 2003, in Somalia, and many other hotspots in his 20-year career. When he retired, he decided to write about his life, about what it was like to stalk a target and pull that trigger. The result is his new book, Shooter, the autobiography of the top-ranked Marine sniper. Tonight, Jack Coughlin explains the role that snipers play in modern warfare and the traits, he says, make a good sniper.
The secret of a good sniper, it's basically, first of all, you have to be able to shoot. And that's evident. But shooting is only 10% of the job. You have to have patience. You have to be good, strong math skills because there's a lot of calculations and formulas you need to know. And you have to be very detailed. You have to be methodical in what you do. if I range a target out with a laser rangefinder at, say, 1,000 yards, that's only going to tell me one factor in the problem. That's going to tell me that 1,000 yards is where the target is. Now I have to factor in wind, barometric pressure, and also the degrees of temperature on the ground, because that's going to all affect the bullet flight and drop. So if I don't have the correct windage for 1,000 yards, if the wind is 7 miles an hour, I have to calculate that. At 1,000 yards, if I'm off 2 or 3 inches, I'm going to completely miss the target. In Iraq, I was a part of 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, and I was a strike task force leader. And what we did is we went around the battlefield whenever the battalion made contact. We would drive our armored Humvees up there and dismount and get into a position where we could engage the enemy with precision fire, giving an overwatch to the enemy, our friendly troops below us, and also eliminating key targets. Once the battle started, it was in an urban environment, so we'd get out of the vehicles and we'd run to a building and get inside it, clear it, and then get up top or to a second or third story window where we could get some elevation to get a better view of the battlefield. And sometimes I would actually fire off the back of the Humvee. I would be sitting on top of it and use that to gain elevation so I could look down on the battlefield. When we're going to engage a target, we go through the rules of engagement. A, it's, you know, if he's in uniform and has a weapon, that's an easy target to identify. B, if they're in civilian clothes and may have a weapon, again, it's kind of easy depending upon the situation at the time, but you want to take a little special extra glance. Maybe he's just defending his own house or his own children or something like that, so you want to look then to look for his intent. And then C, it could be somebody walking around the area directing. There was a case where there was a guy walking around directing. He had a pistol in his pants, and, you know, I pretty much had to decide whether he was directing enemy forces towards us or he's trying to keep the local civilians away from us, and I ended up not shooting him. One of my engagements was, this is a pretty clear-cut engagement, we're running through the town of Afak, and there was two guys in a building, a second-story building, and they're crowded in a window, and they're sticking an RPK light machine gun out, it pointed at our command track. You know, I'd spotted them, I realized that obviously they were enemy and they were getting ready to shoot some of my fellow Marines. So I couldn't tell which one of them had the weapon because they were so squeezed together. They kind of looked like Mutt and Jeff. One was a big, tall guy. One was a short, fat guy. So I centered myself on the target closest to me. I took him down, and the rifle was still there. But luckily, the shock of me shooting his buddy, he looked around to find out who shot his buddy, and that gave me enough time to reload my weapon and take him out also. Well, it's important when you're on the battlefield, you have to be in a certain mindset. You can't go out there looking at these as human beings. You have to look at them as enemy and try to take all the human qualities you can away from them. It's a horrible feeling shooting somebody. I mean, there's nothing good that comes about it. War is a terrible thing, but unfortunately in our society, sometimes it's a necessity. And we're out there protecting. That's the way I look at it. I'm out there protecting my fellow Marines and servicemen. And so when I take a shot, if I have to kill somebody, I know that I feel like a policeman back on the street. If I'm walking down the street and I see a bank robber come out and he's got a hostage, if I don't take out that bank robber, he's going to kill the hostage. It's, you know, it's just a situation that has to be done, even though it's, you know, you take no glory in it.
Jack Coughlin is a retired gunnery sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps. His new book is Shooter, the Autobiography of the Top-Ranked Marine Sniper. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.